15. After a moment of silence, I said, "Did you tell Edgar Barefoot?"
"Yes," Bill said.
"Who else?"
"Almost no one else."
I said, "When did this happen?" And then I said, "You fucking lunatic! It will never end. It goes on and it goes on. One by one, they go mad and die. All I want to do is run my record store and turn on and get laid now and then and read a few books. I never asked for this." My car's tires squealed as I swerved to pass a slow-moving vehicle. We had almost reached the Richmond end of the Richardson Bridge. "Angel," Bill said. He put his hand on my shoulder, tenderly. "Get your goddamn hand off of me," I said. He withdrew his hand.
"I have come back," he said.
"You have gone crazy again, and belong back in the hospital, you hebephrenic nut. Can't you see what this is doing to me, to have to listen to more of this? You know what I thought about you. I thought, there, in a certain real sense, is the only sane one among us. He is labeled as a nut, but he is sane. We are labeled as sane, and we are nuts. And now you. You are the last one I would have expected this from. But I guess..." I broke off. "Shit," I said. "It's out of control, this madness process. I always said to myself, Bill Lundborg is in touch with the real. He thinks about cars. You could have explained to Tim why one does not drive out on the Dead Sea Desert in a Datsun with two bottles of Coke and a gas station map. And now you are as crazy as they were. More crazy." Reaching, I turned up the radio. The sound of the Beatles filled the car. Bill at once shut the radio off, entirely off. "Please slow down," Bill said. "Please," I said. "When we get to the toll gate, get out of the car and hitch a ride with somebody else. And you can tell Edgar Barefoot to go stick his..."
"Don't blame him," Bill said sharply. "I only told him. He didn't tell me. Slow down."
He reached for the ignition key. "Okay," I said, putting my foot on the brake. "You will roll this sardine can," Bill said, "and kill us both. And you don't even have your seatbelt fastened."
"On this day of all days," I said, "the day they murder John Lennon, I have to hear this right now."
"I did not find the Anohi mushroom," Bill said. I said nothing. I simply drove, as best I could.
"I fell," Bill said, "from a cliff."
"Yes," I said, "I read that too, in the Chronicle. Did it hurt?"
By that time I had become unconscious from the sunlight and the heat.
"Well," I said, "apparently you are just not a very bright person to go out there like that." And then suddenly I felt compassion. I felt shame, overwhelming shame at what I was doing to him.
"Bill," I said, "forgive me."
"Sure," he said simply. I thought through my words, and then I said, "When did..." "What am I supposed to call you? Bill or Tim? Are you both now?"
"I'm both. One personality has been formed out of the two. Either name will do. Probably you should call me Bill so that people won't know."
"Why don't you want them to know? I would think something as important and unique as this, as momentous as this, should be known."
Bill said, "They'll put me back in the hospital."
Then I said, "I will call you Bill."
About a month after his death, Tim came back to me. I didn't understand what was happening. I couldn't figure it out. Lights and colors, and then an alien presence in my mind. Another personality, much smarter than me, thinking all sorts of things I never thought. And he knows Greek and Latin and Hebrew and all about theology. He thought about you very clearly. He had wanted to take you with him to Israel. At that, I glanced sharply at him and felt chilled.
"That night at the Chinese restaurant," Bill said, "he tried to talk you into it, but you said you had your life all planned out. You couldn't leave Berkeley."
Taking my foot from the gas pedal, I allowed the car to slow down. It moved more and more slowly until it came to a stop. "It's illegal to stop on the bridge," Bill said, "unless you're having motor trouble or run out of gas, something of that sort. Keep on driving." "Tim told him," I said to myself. Reflexively, I downshifted into low. I started the car up again. "Tim had a crush on you," Bill said. "So?" I said. "That was one reason he wanted to take you to Israel with him." I said, "You speak of Tim in the third person. So in point of fact, you do not identify yourself with Tim, or as Tim. You are Bill Lundborg talking about Tim." "I am Bill Lundborg," he agreed. "But also I am Tim Archer." "Tim wouldn't tell me that," I said, "about being sexually interested in me." "I know," Bill said, "but I am telling you." "What did we have for dinner that night at the Chinese restaurant?" "I have no idea." "Where was the restaurant?"
"In Berkeley."
"Where in Berkeley?"
"I don't remember."
I said, "Tell me what histeron proteron means."
"How would I know that? That's Latin. Tim knows Latin. I don't."
"It's Greek."
"I don't know any Greek."
I pick up Tim's thoughts, and now and then he's thinking in Greek, but I don't know what the Greek means. "What if I believe you?" I said. "What then?"
"Then," Bill said, "you are happy, because your old friend is not dead."
"And that's the point of this?"
He nodded. "Yes."
"It would seem to me," I said carefully, "that there would be a larger point involved. This would be a miracle of staggering importance to the entire world. It is something that scientists should investigate. It proves there is eternal life, that a next world does exist. Everything that Tim and Kirsten believed is in fact true. Here, tyrant death is true. Don't you agree?"
"Yes, I suppose so. That's what Tim is thinking. He thinks that a lot. He wants me to write a book, but I can't write a book. I don't have any writing talent."
"You can act as Tim's secretary, the way your mother did. Tim can dictate, and you can write it all down."
He rattles on and on, a mile a minute. I've tried to write it down, but his thinking is fucked, if you'll pardon the expression. It's all disorganized. It goes everywhere and nowhere. And I don't know half the words. In fact, a lot of it isn't words at all, just impressions.
Can you hear him now?"
"No, not right now.
It's usually when I'm alone and no one else is talking. Then I can sort of tune in on it."
"Histeron proteron," I murmured, "when the thing to be demonstrated is included in the premise. So it's all in vain, the reasoning."
"Bill," I said, "I've got to hand it to you. You have me tied up in a knot. You really have. Does Tim remember backing over the gas pump?"
"Never mind. Fuck the gas pump."
Bill said, "It's a presence of mind. See, Tim was in that area. The word presence reminded me. He uses that word a lot. The presence, as he calls it, was there in the desert."
"The Perugia," I said.
"Right," Bill emphatically nodded.
"That would be Anokhi," I said.
"Would it?
What he was looking for?"
"Apparently he found it," I said. "What did Barefoot say to all this?"
"That's when he told me, when he realized, I was a bodhisattva. I came back. Tim came back, I mean, out of compassion for others, for those he loves. Such as you."
"What is Barefoot going to do with this news?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing," I echoed, nodding. "There's no way I can prove it," Bill said, "to skeptical minds. Edgar pointed that out."
"Why can't you prove it? It should be easy to prove it. You have access to everything Tim knew. Like you said, all the theology, details of his personal life, facts. It should be the most simple matter on earth to prove."
"Can I prove it to you?"
Bill said. I can't even prove it to you. It's like belief in God. You can know God, know He exists, you can experience Him, and yet you can never prove to anyone else that you've experienced Him. Do you believe in God now? I said. Sure. He nodded. I guess you believe in a lot of things now, I said. Because of Tim in me, I know a lot of things. It isn't just belief. It's like, he gestured earnestly, having swallowed a computer, or the whole Britannica, a whole library. The facts, the ideas, come and go and just whiz around in my head. They go too fast, that's the problem. I don't understand them. I can't remember them. I can't write them down or explain them to other people. It's like having KPFA turned on inside your head 24 hours a day, without cease. In many respects, it's an affliction, but it's interesting. Have fun with your thoughts, I said to myself. That is what Harry Stack Sullivan said schizophrenics do. They have endless fun with their thoughts and forget the world. There is not much you can say when someone unveils an account such as Bill Lundborg's, assuming that anyone ever unveiled such a narration before. It did, of course, resemble what Tim and Kirsten had revealed to me. That is the wrong word. When they returned from England after Jeff's death. But that had been minor compared with this. This, I thought, consists of the ultimate escalation, the monument itself. The other narration was only the marker pointing to the monument. Madness, like small fish, runs in hosts, in vast numbers of instances. It is not solitary. Madness does not remain content. It fans out across the landscape, or seascape, whichever. Yes, I thought, it is like we are underwater, not in a dream, as Barefoot says, but in a tank, and being observed for our bizarre behavior and our more bizarre beliefs. I am a metaphor junkie. Bill Lundborg is a madness junkie, unable to get enough of it. He possesses a boundless appetite for it, and will obtain it by whatever means possible. Just when it seemed, too, as if madness had passed out of the world. First John Lennon's death, and now this. And for me, on the same day. I could not say, and yet he is so plausible, because Bill was not plausible. It is not a plausible matter. Probably even Edgar Barefoot recognized that. Well, however a Sufi phrases such mosca to himself, that someone is sick and needs help, but is touchingly appealing, is guileless, and not going to do any harm. This madness arose from pain, from the loss of a mother, and what almost certainly amounted to a father in the true sense of the word. I felt it. I feel it. I always will feel it, as long as I live. But Bill's solution could not be mine. Any more than mine, managing the record store, could be his. We each must find our own solution, and in particular, we each must solve the sort of problem that death creates for others. But not death only, madness also, madness leading to final death as its end state, its logical goal. When my original anger at Bill Lundborg's psychosis had subsided, it did subside, I began to view it as funny. The utility of Bill Lundborg, not just for himself, but, as I viewed it, to all of us, consisted in his grounding in the concrete. This, precisely, he had lost. His showing up at Edgar Barefoot's seminar disclosed the change in Bill. The kid I had known, formerly known, would never have set foot in such surroundings. Bill had gone the way of the rest of us. Not the way of all flesh, but the way of our intellects, into nonsense and the foolish, there to languish without a trace of anything redemptive. Except, of course, Bill could now emotionally deal with the assortment of deaths that had plagued us. Was my solution any better? I worked, I read, I listened to music, I bought music in the form of records. I lived a professional life and yearned to move into the A&R division of Capitol Records down in Southern California. There my future lay. There were the tangible things that records had become for me. Not something to enjoy, but something to first buy and then sell. That the bishop had returned from the next world and now inhabited Bill Lundborg's mind or brain, that couldn't be, for obvious reasons. One knows this instinctively. One does not debate this. One perceives this as absolute fact. It cannot happen. I could quiz Bill forever, trying to establish the presence in him of facts known only to me and to Tim, but this would lead nowhere. Like the dinner Tim and I had eaten at the Chinese restaurant on University Avenue in Berkeley, all data became suspect, because there are multiple ways that data can arise within the human mind, ways more readily acceptable and explained than to assume that one man died in Israel and his psyche floated halfway across the world until it discriminated Bill Lundborg from all the other people in the United States, and then dove into that person, into that waiting brain, and took up residence there, to sputter with ideas, thoughts, and memories, half-baked notions. In other words, the bishop as we had known him, the bishop himself, like a sort of plasma. This does not lie within the domain of the real. It lies elsewhere. It is the invention of derangement, of a young man who grieved over the suicide of his mother and the sudden death of a father figure, grieved and tried to understand. And one day into Bill's mind came not Bishop Timothy Archer, but the concept of Timothy Archer, the notion that Timothy Archer was there, in him, spiritually, a ghost. There is a difference between the notion of something and that something itself. Still, upon the lessening of my original anger, I felt sympathy toward Bill, because I understood why he had gone this route. He had not willed it out of perversity. It did not consist of, so to speak, optional madness, but rather madness compelled on him, thrust onto him forcibly, whether he liked it or not. It had simply happened. Bill Lundborg, the first of us to be crazy, had become now the last of us to be crazy. The only genuine issue could best be phrased this way: could anything be done about it? Which raises a deeper question: should anything be done about it? I pondered that during the next couple of weeks. Bill, he told me, had no major friends. He lived alone in a rented room in East Oakland, eating his meals at a Mexican cafe. Perhaps, I said to myself, I owe it to Jeff and Kirsten and Tim, to Tim especially, to straighten Bill out. That way there would be a survivor, that is, of course, in addition to myself. Indubitably, I had survived, but survived, as I had for some time realized, as a machine. Still, this is survival. At least my mind had not been invaded by alien intelligences who thought in Greek, Latin, and Hebrew, and used terms I could not comprehend. Anyhow, I liked Bill. It would not be a burden on me to see him again, to spend time with him. Together, Bill and I could summon back the people we had loved. These were the same people we had known, and our pooled memories would yield up a great crop of circumstantial details, the little bits that made of memory the semblance of the veridical, which is an ornate way of saying that my seeing Bill Lundborg would make it possible for me to experience Tim and Kirsten and Jeff again, because Bill, like me, had once experienced them, and would understand who I was talking about. Anyhow, we both were attending Edgar Barefoot's seminar. Bill and I would run into each other there, for better or worse. My respect for Barefoot had climbed, due, of course, to the personal interest he had taken in me. I had warmed to that. I needed that. Barefoot had sensed it. I interpreted Bill's statement that the bishop had been interested in me sexually as an oblique way of saying that he himself was interested in me sexually. I pondered that and came to the conclusion that Bill was too young for me. Anyhow, why get involved with someone classified as a hebephrenic schizophrenic? Hampton, who had had traces, rather more than traces, of paranoia and hypomania, had been enough trouble, and it had been difficult to rid myself of him. In fact, it was not demonstrable that I had gotten rid of him. Hampton still phoned me. complaining aggressively that when I kicked him out of my house, I had kept certain choice records, books, and prints that in truth belonged to him. What bothered me about my getting involved with Bill lay in my sense of the ferocity of madness. It can consume its owner, leave him, look around for more. If I was a rickety machine, I stood in danger of that madness, for I was not all that psychologically intact. Enough people had gone mad and died already. Why add myself to the list? And perhaps worst of all, I discerned the kind of future that awaited Bill. He had no future. Someone with hebephrenia has dealt himself out of the game of process, growth, and time. He simply recycles his own nutty thoughts forever, enjoying them even though, like transmitted information, they degenerate. They become, finally, noise, and the signal that is intellect fades out. Bill would know this, having planned at one time to become a computer programmer. He would be familiar with Shannon's information theories. This is not the sort of thing you want to tie into. Bringing my little brother Harvey along, I picked up Bill on my day off and drove up into Tilden Park by Lake Anza and the clubhouse and barbecue stoves. There the three of us broiled hamburgers, and we tossed a frisbee around and had a hell of a time. We had brought a ghetto blaster with us, one of those super-sophisticated two-channel, two-speaker combination radio and tape-deck masterpieces that Japan turns out, and we listened to the rock group Queen, and we drank beer, except for Harvey, and ran around, and then when it didn't seem anyone was watching or cared, Bill and I shared a joint. Harvey, while we did that, tried out all the heat sensor controls of the ghetto blaster, and then concentrated on picking up Radio Moscow on its short wave. "You can go to jail for that," Bill told him, listening to the enemy. "Bull," Harvey said. "I wonder what Tim and Kirsten would say," I said to Bill, "if they could see us now." "I can tell you what Tim is saying," Bill said. "What does he say?" I said, relaxed by the marijuana. Bill said, "He says that he's thinking that it is peaceful here, that he has finally found peace." "Good," I said. "I could never get him to smoke grass." "They smoked it," Bill said. "Him and Kirsten, when we weren't around. He didn't like it, but he likes it now." "This is very good grass," I said. "They probably had local stuff. They wouldn't know the difference." I pondered over what Bill had said. "Did they really turn on? Is that true?" "Yes," Bill said. "He's thinking about that now. He's remembering." I regarded him. "In a way, you're lucky," I said, "to find your solution. I wouldn't mind having him in me. In my brain, I mean." I giggled. It was that kind of grass. "Then I wouldn't be so lonely." And then I said, "Why didn't he come back to me? Why to you? I knew him better." After a moment of reflection, Bill said, "Because it would have wrecked you. See, I'm used to voices in my head and thoughts that aren't my own. I can accept it." "It's Tim that's the bodhisattva, not you," I said. "It was Tim who came back out of compassion." And then I thought with a start, "My God, do I believe it now? When you're high on good grass, you can believe anything, which is why it sells for as much as it does now." "That's right," Bill said. "I can feel his compassion. He sought wisdom, the holy wisdom of God, what Tim calls Hagia Sophia. He equates it with Anohi, God's pure consciousness. And then when he got there and the presence entered him, he realized that it was not wisdom that he wanted, but compassion. He already had wisdom, but it hadn't done him or anyone else any good." "Yes," I said. "He mentioned Hagia Sophia to me." "That's some of the Latin he thinks in." "Greek." "Whatever. Tim thought that with Christ's absolute wisdom he could read the Book of the Spinners and untangle the future for Tim, so Tim could figure out a way to evade his fate. That's why he went to Israel." "I know," I said. Christ can read the book of the spinners, Bill said. The fate of every human is inscribed in it. No human being has ever read it.
Where is this book?
All around us, Bill said. I think, anyhow. Wait a sec. Tim is thinking something. Very clearly. He remained silent and withdrawn for a time. Tim is thinking the last canto. Canto 33 of Paradiso. He's thinking, God is the book of the universe. And you read that. You read it the night you had the abscessed tooth. Is that right? Bill asked me. That's right, I said. It made a great impression on me, that whole last part of the Commedia. Edgar says that the Divine Comedy is based on Sufi sources, Bill said. Maybe so, I said, wondering about what Bill had said, the statements about Dante's Commedia. Strange, I said, the things you remember and why you remember them. Because I had an abscessed tooth. Tim says that Christ arranged that pain, Bill said, so the final part of the Divine Comedy would impress itself on you in a way that would never wear off. One simple flame. Oh, shit, he's thinking in a foreign language again. Say it out loud, I said, as he thinks it. Bill haltingly said, Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai per una selva oscura che la diritta via era smarrita. I smiled. That's how the Commedia begins. There's more, Bill said. Lasciate ogni speranza, voi che entrate. Abandon all hope, you who enter here, I said. He wants me to tell you one thing more, Bill said, but I'm having trouble catching it. Oh, now I have it. He thought it again very clearly for me. La sua volontate è nostra pace. I don't recognize that, I said. Tim says it's the basic message of the Divine Comedy. It means, His will is our peace. Meaning God, I guess. I guess so, I said. He must have learned that in the next world, Bill said. He certainly didn't learn it here. Approaching us, Harvey said, I'm tired of the Queen tapes. What else did we bring? Did you manage to pick up Radio Moscow? I asked. Yeah, but the voice jammed it. The Russians switched to another frequency, probably the 30-meter band, but I got tired of looking for it. The voice always jams it. We'll be going home soon, I said, and passed the remains of the joint to Bill.